From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with a new report that outlines what could be a life-changing goal for many people across this country. The National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine released a report in June with its recommendations for how to make amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, a livable disease in the next decade. According to the National Academies, at least 30,000 people in the United States are living with ALS on any given day. You may know it as Lou Gehrig's disease. It's a progressive neurological disease which currently does not have a cure. But patients, caregivers, and experts across medical disciplines related to ALS care want to improve the quality of life for people living with the disease. That's where that new report comes in. And this hour, we talked to experts, caregivers, and people living with ALS about improving quality of life for patients and families. And I'd like to welcome our guest now. Dr. Joel Shemaskin is back with us. He's a retired emeritus professor at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry and the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine Study Committee contributor. He's living with ALS himself. Joel, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Thanks, Ben.
Also with us in studio is Kathy Powers, who was a caregiver for her late husband, Brian. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Also with us is Dr. Charles Thornton, who is a professor of neurology at UR Medicine. Thank you for being with us.
Glad to be here.
And Rebecca Coulter is with us on the line, a licensed social worker, managing director of care services at the ALS Association. Hello, Rebecca. Thanks for being with us.
Good afternoon.
Rebecca, let me just start with you. How significant was this June report? And is there a single headline that jumps out to you as we talk about ALS?
Great question. I think that the report is significant because we've not done something like this before. So I think that this is the first step in moving towards that goal of making ALS livable for people living with ALS currently.
And Rebecca, I mean, that's a phrase that it hits my ears. I think I know what you're saying, but when you say we want to make this disease livable, mm-hmm. can you just describe a little more of what you mean?
Sure, absolutely. We want to improve access and equity. We want to make sure that all people living with ALS have access to the care and treatment available to increase length of life, to improve quality of life, and get us to a place where individuals are living with ALS longer, where individuals are no longer being told at the time of their diagnosis that they have just 2 to 5 years.
We are going to post a link to the report on our show notes for listeners to access it. This is a report that recommends actions from the public, from private and nonprofit sectors that would achieve this goal of making ALS a livable disease within the next decade. And there are different a wide range of experts who worked on this in neurology, rehabilitation, pulmonary, primary care, on and on it goes, public health, people with lived experience, caregivers. So it's pretty comprehensive. And Dr. Thornton, is there a headline that jumps out to you from this?
I appreciated the report because it recognizes that it's been a tough nut to crack to find better treatments, and that we have to do a better job now of working with the tools that we have to make it a livable disease and dedicate more effort to getting the breakthrough treatment that can stop it or reverse it.
Again, listeners, if it affects you now, I mean, if this is a disease that's in your immediate sphere, you're going to want to read the report. But, I mean, the reality is I think it affects more people than you realize. It's true of just about any affliction I've ever come across. When breast cancer is in your sphere, when ALS is in your sphere, it occurs to you how many people around you have experienced a family member with it. And, you know, Kathy's one of them was a caregiver for her late husband, Brian. Lost him just about a year ago now, yes?
Yes, Sunday was a year.
And I am sorry for your loss. Can you tell us a little bit about what your experience was like with Brian?
Sure. So there's a couple different types of ALS, and Brian had familial ALS, which is hereditary, and his mom had passed away from ALS in 2009. So we were very well educated about what ALS was when he was diagnosed, and he was left-handed, and he started just by having tingling in his fingers, his left hand, his dominant hand. And was able to use that hand as well as the rest of his body for the first couple of years. But then by the beginning of year 3, he had lost the use of both hands. was his legs were very weak, his abdomen was very weak, and of course the breathing and the swallowing and the eating situation, you know, had gotten much worse. So he had he lived with it for about 3 years, but in his case, it was just a constant state of decline. What's the next decline? What's the next decline? What's the next adjustment that we're making to help him to keep going and to live and to do as much as he could while he could, knowing that it was just going to continue to get harder for him.
You know, given the family history and the knowledge going into that, you and him were probably better positioned than many people would be to at least understand what was happening and maybe to anticipate or to ask questions. Did you at least feel that the course of his disease, I don't know if easier is the right word, but I mean, were you able to navigate it with that knowledge any better than you think maybe someone who didn't have that knowledge?
Perhaps. In some ways, it was hard to have the knowledge because we knew exactly, you know, what the outcome was going to be. It was hopeless from the beginning, so that was very difficult. But we quickly became educated in the breakthroughs that that research had provided in the time that his mom passed away to when Brian passed away, which was primarily the ability to diagnose the illness properly and know that it was a gene mutation. But in terms of treatments, he took the same drug that his mom took, and it really, you know, doesn't do a whole lot, to be honest with you. And I think the other thing that had happened was I had breast cancer several years ago, and so because of that, I felt a very comfortable advocating for myself and very comfortable advocating for Brian. So we were not shy about asking questions and getting information and kind of thinking ahead what would come next and how do we get prepared for that in advance so we're not in an emergent situation.
Kathy, I mean, I admire you for talking publicly about this because I know you're helping people with it, and it can't be easy. And another big part of this that could not have been easy was, you know, you get that diagnosis, and as you say, you kind of know it's coming. I can't help but think that when you see the research and the progress that's being made in some ways, and this report is indicative of some of that, I think it's very human to wonder how fast will that progress come. And at the same time, you start talking about, do we settle his estate? Do we settle his affairs? And you did that, didn't you?
We did. We made the decision to do that. And I understand from multiple conversations with his neurologist at the time that some families choose to do that and some families choose not to. We chose to do it because Brian wanted to be involved in decisions, and he wanted to know that I would be well taken care of once he was gone. So we did that, and that on top of taking care of him and watching him decline and all of that was another layer of just emotional complexity and sadness.
Can you empathize with families and people who decide not to do that?
I think it just comes down to personal preference.
Yeah.
We just chose to do it because he wanted to be a part of it. Some other people don't. They don't feel the need to, or they just don't want to, or maybe they just don't feel that they have the capacity to do that at the same time that they're taking care of somebody.
Is there something that maybe the public that hasn't experienced ALS up close usually gets wrong or doesn't understand, or is there something that you think listeners should really understand about this disease that you think would make us better equipped if it is in our lives?
I think I don't know if everybody knows that there is no cure and that ultimately, you know, it's a fatal illness. It's not like other illnesses where, in my case, I had breast cancer. I had stage one breast cancer, but it was very treatable. We took care of it. I went through my treatments and it was gone. So I could look forward to carrying on and just living a normal life. That's not the case with ALS. And I don't know that everyone is aware of the physical decline. I think as we were going through the journey and, you know, Brian's friends would come visit, and in some cases there would be a significant difference from the last time they saw him, particularly with his speech and just his just overall weakness and being able to not get up out of a chair, for example, by himself. So I think some people were just not prepared for what the decline is, and they were sort of shocked and afraid.
Did you find that there was enough support for you? And I I'm thinking about you because I'm thinking about my aunt who lost her husband to ALS. And she needed back surgery. She needed a lot. I mean, it was very difficult and just in terms of the physicality of it. Mm-hmm. And her life has been difficult since then. I hope you had support. And was it? Are you concerned about families getting that support necessary as the disease progresses?
I felt very well supported between the medical staff that we were working with and the resources that we had. I felt supported in that regard, and I knew where to turn when we had questions or we needed to know what to do for Brian. In terms of myself, I was working at the time. I've since retired, but I was working at the time, and I was very, very well supported by my employer. They understood what was going on. They gave me special permission to work from home so that I could be with Brian, 24/7. And when he passed away and I did go back to work for a little while, they were very accommodating and understanding of the complexity of what had happened. We also have lots of family and friends that were very helpful. Just in terms of keeping in touch with us, visiting, offering to help with things that they could help with, and just keeping in touch and being supportive.
I think that's an important message for anyone who knows someone, a loved one with ALS. It's always good to check in, maybe be around. Probably just physical presence can be helpful. Does the recent report, does it give you any renewed idea of hope for the future for people with ALS?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. I have a very, very heavy burden emotionally with ALS.
Yeah.
Because it's hereditary in our family, there's 7 other family members that are either know that they have the gene mutation or know that they have the potential to have ALS. So it's been very invasive in our family, and I still have a very heavy emotional burden.
Dr. Thornton, hearing Kathy describe familial ALS and hearing her reaction to this report, I can understand why it's can be a little bit jaundiced by experience and concern for the future. Is this a typical kind of story for families that have this gene mutation? And is there research going on? Is there something that we should know that might offer some kind of hope for this changing in the future?
I understand a certain undercurrent of skepticism that things could change in the near future. There was a hope when the genes that cause ALS were first being discovered that would unravel the mystery, and that then with that understanding, some potent treatments could be devised. And it's been slow for that to unfold. But it is making progress. The treatments for people who have the genetic forms depend on which gene is causing the trouble. It's recently a new treatment has come to pass that is targeted at one of these genes, and it's having quite a strong effect on people who have that. So for the first time in my practice with ALS people, I met someone who was actually stopped getting worse and then showed actual improvement while taking a treatment for genetic ALS.
As part of a trial?
He was in a trial, yeah. And then the drug was approved,
okay.
And he continues to receive it now outside of any research context, as do others who have that same gene problem now. And I think we'll get to see now for the first time what happens when people who carry a particular gene start taking treatment at the first possible moment that their symptoms develop. And we'll have to start to learn whether it's wise sometimes to administer treatment before symptoms develop.
In family situations like Kathy's, right?
Yes.
Where you've got 7 family. Okay. So it sounds like a lot more research is needed in that way, but this is research that is very specific in what you're looking for. I mean, that, in a way, that is hopeful to me. You'll at least get some information there, won't you?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a good first example, and now we really need to push on that hard.
Okay. Can I ask Rebecca Coulter, who's with the ALS Association, how you not only hear Kathy's story, but how you think about this kind of research that might offer a different roadmap for treatment in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that to Dr. Thornton's point and Kathy's, familial ALS is about 5 to 10% of all ALS cases, and there are over 40 genetic mutations that have been identified at this point. But up until this most recent study and medication that Dr. Thornton is speaking about, we didn't have a therapeutic to treat any one genetic mutation specifically. So it is really exciting in that it's opening up a new pathway. I mean, obviously, this work has been done over many years. The research takes a really long time for many reasons, but certainly it does provide some hope, I think, for folks who are in the unique position of having been impacted many times over in their families with this really awful, terrible disease process. I think that one thing that's very clear, certainly from the work that we do and naturally from the results of this study, is that, we need a significant investment in ALS research moving forward. I think that, researchers, as far as I can tell, are really hopeful about some of the progress that's being made. And it all costs money. And so so that investment in ALS research is really critical to keep us moving forward, to keep us in a place of being able to identify additional treatments that, maybe they're not doing what we hope that they'll do and that they stop disease progression or reverse it. But we do want to get to that point. And if it means that we are also identifying additional, treatments along the way that could perhaps slow it in the interim, then that is progress. The families that we're working with want any and all opportunities available to address, to slow the disease progression, to be able to live their lives with ALS.
Well, it was about 2.5 years ago that we met Dr. Joel Shemaskin here, and it is nice to see you back, Joel. I want to ask you first how you're doing these days.
Really good, Evan. Thank you. Thanks.
Your diagnosis of ALS was how long ago now?
Eight plus years.
Okay. And I think today is the first time that some listeners might be hearing that there are different kinds, familial and different kinds of ALS. How do you feel 8.5 years? I mean, you look good. I know that there's different progression going on, but are you where you thought you would be? And how are you feeling going forward, Joel?
I mean, in the first year to two, it was really unclear what would happen, and that led to a lot of immediate changes in terms of decisions about work and things like that. I stopped practicing right away, but as I quickly learned, as is the case with many people with ALS, the trajectory of decline, once it begins on a certain path, often remains on that same trajectory for years and years to come. So, and this isn't the case with everyone, but someone who is declining at the pace that I am may continue declining at that same very slow rate as they began with. So I obviously am feeling very fortunate. Clearly, I think a lot of it has to do with the support that I do have from my wife and family and friends. And a lot of it is just luck, Evan. I mean, it could have gone a different way, but I think the fact that this is declining slowly gives me the opportunity to do things like this where I can talk about it and be involved in things that push advocacy forward, because ALS, just as you said, although it's considered a rare disease at about 30,000 people in the U.S. at one time, it's the lifetime risk is about 1 in 400, which is about the same as multiple sclerosis. And people know a lot about MS and often know many people with it. So it's, it just as you said, if you don't know someone with it yet, you will. I'm feeling hopeful. I'm not about me personally, although I am hopeful and I'm very optimistic. But I think this report lays out ways in which the country and the ALS organizations and nonprofits and industry, if they come together, can really move things forward.
We're going to talk more about this report in just a moment. Let me ask you a little bit, Joel, and you heard Kathy talk about Brian getting some tingling in his left hand. He was left-handed, and as kind of that early indicator, and then symptoms over 3 years progressed pretty steadily for Brian and their experience. In your case, I asked this because I think for people, I don't want to be exploitative. I want people to understand that ALS doesn't progress in everyone exactly the same way or at the same speed as we're seeing. But over time, there is obvious changes in what you can do physically. And for you, are you mindful day to day, week to week, month to month of what, you know, where your limitations are to literally protect your physical health? Do you notice them? Are there certain physical tests or kind of drills that you're doing with yourself to make sure you can still do what you want to do?
I mean, it's more day to day in terms of recognizing what I know I can or what I should not do. And I think for people listening who may have someone with ALS in their family, or especially if they are new to the diagnosis, one of the biggest mistakes I made was overestimating initially what was okay to do. I think when someone develops any disease that is affecting their mobility and balance and strength, they may assume they can continue to safely do the things that they couldn't always do before. I paid the consequences with some falls and fractures and things because simply I was not as cognizant as I should have been. So now I think, to answer your question, I'm constantly aware of what I should and shouldn't do.
How do you think our listeners should understand not only the toll of ALS on yourself, but also what it means for caregivers?
I think one of the strengths of this report is that it really does a couple of things related to caregivers. It gives voice to the experience that they have. The experience of being a caregiver for someone with ALS is, I think, pretty unique. I mean, the experience of a caregiver for other neurological diseases or disabilities is a challenge as well. But with ALS, often, as Kathy described, the decline can be fairly quick. And the caregiver is constantly needing to make adjustments. So adjustment to their home, their schedule in terms of how much they need to be around. Many caregivers need to stop work or significantly cut back on their work, and that takes a social and psychological and financial toll on the family. So the burden on caregivers is huge. They are dealing with not only their loved one with the disease and seeing them change, but with ALS being such a complex disease, especially when the person is advancing quickly, the caregiver may need to become an expert in handling a feeding tube, monitoring a ventilator or a non-invasive ventilator machine, dealing with insurance, dealing with paid caregivers at home, all the while, if they are a parent, taking care of their children at home. Often, one thing people don't realize with ALS is that being diagnosed in one's 20s or 30s is not rare. So we all have met people with it at that young age, and then when there's a parent dealing with their spouse who is declining and young children, that's almost hard to imagine doing. So I think the burden on them is really great, and I think this report makes a lot of specific recommendations for the government and others to help them.
After we take this only break, we're going to talk about more about that report, and we'll ask Rebecca Coulter with the ALS Association much more about that. You just heard Dr. Joel Shemaskin, who is a retired professor at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry and a National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine Study Committee contributor. Joel is living with ALS himself. Kathy Powers is with us. She was the caregiver for her late husband, Brian, helping tell his story. Dr. Charles Thornton is with us, professor of neurology at UR Medicine. And if you've got questions, comments on ALS, you can email the program, connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. We're right back. I'm Evan Dawson, Friday on The Next Connections. In our first hour, what makes a neighborhood special? What makes your neighborhood unique? Different neighborhood organizations are working together in Rochester to kind of co-promote, and we'll talk about what they are doing and what you might experience from it. In our second hour, a conversation with someone who is rather an expert in polling, and we're talking about what the current polling numbers in the presidential race mean. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So we're going to post a link to the report that we're talking about and the show notes section here. And if you want to learn more about ALS, if you want to learn more about what this report says about ALS now and in the future and what could change and improve quality of life, livability of ALS, it's all there. But just looking at sort of a summation here, you just heard Dr. Shemaskin talking about caregiving. And the report's recommendations could impact caregiving in significant ways here. If implemented, the recommendations in the report could address the following: insurance coverage for home health aide, direct financial support through tax credits or stipends, mental health resources, respite care, training for key equipment and care needs, and different national advocacy priorities related to caregiving. Rebecca Coulter, who is a licensed social worker, managing director of care services at the ALS Association, can you describe how significant you think things could change for caregivers if some of these recommendations take effect?
Yeah, if the recommendations take effect, I think it could be pretty transformational for caregivers. I understand that the last time that the National Academies did a study, they were focusing on ALS in the military. And within a couple of years, the Veterans Administration was able to determine that ALS was a service-related disease. And as such, you know, veterans living with ALS and their families are eligible now for a whole host of services and benefits that they were not eligible for before. And so, you know, my hope is that we're able to take the most critical recommendations and help to move those forward now, you know, identifying which ones maybe have a shorter turnaround time and which ones are going to require a little bit more time and effort and collaboration to actually cross the finish line.
As you know, Kathy, as you look at some of the recommendations and you think about what you and your family have gone through before Brian's passing, are you optimistic that at least for caregivers that there is some support to come?
I think so, because as you know, right now, what our experience was we were certainly under the very good care of a neurologist, and he too was always thinking ahead to the next thing, but then it always came back to us or to me to go out and figure that thing out, whether it was, you know, you need to go meet with a speech pathologist or you need to go meet with a physical therapist. They certainly made the referral, but then we had to make the arrangements. We had to physically get Brian there. We had to understand what they were talking about, relay it back to the doctor. So while they could direct us to different places, the legwork was still up to me on top of working up to a certain point and taking care of Brian and just regular doctor's appointments for him.
How often did you, and I don't know the answer in advance, I'm just curious to know how often you would think about what was recommended or trying to set up these different services or appointments and think, is this covered? I mean, how much is out of pocket? I mean, do those questions come up?
They do. When Brian decided to retire, he retired 3 months after he was diagnosed, which was a choice he made to be able to spend his good time left doing the things that made him happy, pursuing his hobbies. But he had disability insurance through his employer, so that was fine. We applied for Social Security disability insurance, which he was approved for, and was automatically approved for Medicare. So I was not familiar with Medicare up until that point, but I became very familiar with it, and they were very easy to work with, to be honest with you. And there was a lot that was covered between medical equipment, different specialists that we worked with, regular doctor's appointments, medication. There was a lot that was covered. We paid very little out of pocket for 3 years' worth of care for him.
That gives me some optimism.
Yes.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yes, I was too.
Because, I mean, we all have stories about what doesn't get covered. Joel, you want to jump in here?
So I'm super happy that Kathy and Brian's experience was that way, but it's not that way for everyone. Medicare, for instance, there are rules about employment history that does not allow some people, especially if they're younger, when they apply to get approved for Medicare. So one of the recommendations in the report is for Congress and CMS to change that.
Okay. I'm thinking about Dr. Thornton here, who was nodding along with Kathy's story, you know, consulting with neurologists, but then kind of having to do a lot on her own here. What do you want to see change for caregivers?
Oh, there's so many challenges that they face, and you make a change at the home and in your lives, and you feel like you're in a stable situation and things are livable for a while, and then in a week or a month they change again, and you have to make another adaptation. So it's sometimes I think to families it feels like a continuous onslaught. For many of the problems that come up, there are relatively straightforward, practical ways to try and deal with them in terms of mobility, keeping people's independence. And so it is possible for policy changes like the ones that are recommended here to have quite an impact. And I well remember when, after a person was disabled from ALS, there was a lengthy period of time before they were eligible for Social Security disability and for Medicare benefits, during which they were just kind of, it was 6 months or longer, during which they were just kind of in a holding pattern and had no place to turn. And that was a simple legislation, just needed to fix it. And I think there's some other problems that could be fixed too.
Well, let me get some questions and comments from listeners who have been listening today. And I'll start with William, who says, Evan, thank you for discussing this topic. Our 71-year-old neighbor and our close friend was recently diagnosed with ALS. It took a long time to diagnose it. We think he's 2 years into it. We love our friends. How can we help them as the disease progresses? That is from William. Can I start with Kathy on that question? What would you say to them, Kathy?
I would say that your proximity of being a neighbor is actually very helpful. You know, keep in touch. See how they're doing with things around the house. Maybe they need some help out in the yard. Maybe you could run an errand for them here or there. Socialization, certainly. Go over and visit and say hello. Are all very important.
That proximity is, I was just with family this past weekend helping do some caregiving for a family member. And it's amazing how quickly you start thinking about how to navigate a house when movement is not easy. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I left over the last 3 days with was thinking, I hope the neighbors will check in more often. I hope that there will be physical presence. You know, I'm thinking of my nephews and others who are around. I'm saying, stop in, just go there, just pop in. Not to invade anybody's privacy, but to physically be there, because I have family members who, if you ask them, do you need help? They'll say, no, you know, no, I'm okay. And they don't want to ask for it. But when you're there, things change. Mm-hmm. And so that physical proximity that William is talking about here seems particularly important, Kathy.
Well, and for somebody, you live right next door, so you're there all the time, right? So if you check in on the person every day or every 2 days, you'll notice within the house or outside the house if there's something that isn't being taken care of, that isn't about the physical care of the patient, but more to do with their household or just something around the house that you can be helpful with.
Let me ask the rest of the panel if they want to respond to William's email. Dr. Shemaskin?
So this brings up the more broad topic of our actual respite care. Now, respite care under most insurance situations is not a covered benefit. However, for the 1 in 6 people in this country who 1 in 6 people in the country with ALS who are veterans, the coverage through the VA, especially for caregivers, is really exemplary. That includes respite care. There is a stipend for the caregiver. There are funds for home modification up to about $100,000, money for modified vehicles. So this system of respite care needs to be included in new models of care and coverage. And so there's a model that exists in our country already that we feel that CMS and insurers could adopt to improve the experience.
Dr. Thornton, what would you say to William about helping his neighbor?
Kathy brought this up early in terms of it kind of takes an army sometimes. And those of us who have family close can draw on family, but you need even more beyond family, friends who can step in, church members. And not everyone has those resources, though. And I worry particularly about those who do not, and what can be done to fill those gaps. And right now there isn't a lot that can be brought to bear for them, and we definitely need to do better at that.
Rebecca Coulter with the ALS Association, can you weigh in too?
Absolutely. I'll speak to William's question specifically, though my mind started racing after Dr. Thornton's comment. I think that if you're willing to help, it can be helpful to be specific in the ways that you're willing to help, especially for those individuals that are maybe unsure about accepting offers of assistance. I think it shows that you're being intentional and really truly willing to show up for that individual or that family. And then I think I would say keep showing up. You know, things will get more difficult. They'll get increasingly difficult. And in my experience, not everyone sticks around. And so it can be really meaningful to have people that are checking in on you.
William, good luck to you and much love to you. I think that they're your neighbors are fortunate to have good friends, and I know that you're going to be that for them. Chris emailed to ask, said that you've been talking about hereditary ALS. Can you talk about what causes ALS in the first place? That is from Chris. Dr. Thornton, do you want to address that one?
Yeah, the answer's pretty short. We don't know. And this is probably one of the top 10 questions in medicine that mm-hmm. remains a mystery. And the importance of trying to solve that riddle is that until you know exactly what's going on, it's very hard to shape a treatment that deals with it fundamentally, and everything else becomes then sort of a shot in the dark. So a lot of work has been done to try and find the answer, and it's been very hard. Clues have been found, but no final answers. There are some things in the environment that might raise a person's risk of ALS, but none of them seem to have very powerful effects. The question of why veterans seem to have about twice the frequency of ALS as other folks hasn't been answered. And there might be some physical activities that raise the risk of having ALS. I wouldn't go so far as to say that they cause ALS, but there's some indication that people in certain sports, this has been claimed in baseball and football and in professional soccer, have a higher risk of ALS. So it might be that in certain situations that overuse of these nerves and muscles can raise the risk of having ALS.
Rebecca Coulter, anything you want to add there?
No, I think Dr. Thornton did a good job of answering that question. Yeah.
Okay, and I'm going back to the report, and I'm looking at where a lot of people's minds go here is what is the state of research and drug development. So some of the recommendations: the NIH should ensure the existence of a dedicated ALS clinical trials network, distributed across diverse geographic regions and integrated with the proposed ALS care delivery network, to enable every individual with ALS to participate in clinical trials if they desire. A widespread clinical trials network would also reach more diverse ethnic, racial, and socioeconomic populations. That's just one recommendation in this report. And, Dr. Thornton, you mentioned earlier, I think you mentioned the only time you've seen a patient with some ALS symptoms slow and even start to reverse was someone participating in a clinical trial. My doctor friends always tell me that if you are ever diagnosed with a very serious disease, get in a trial if you can. Don't be afraid of trials. Trials are good to participate in trials as a general rule of thumb. So I'm surprised to hear that this clinical trials network doesn't exist already. What do you make of this recommendation here?
Well, I think it's a good one. And the vision I think that we hold for this is modeled somewhat after cancer treatment. And in the United States, a high fraction of people with a new diagnosis of cancer have an opportunity to participate in trials. And that has helped over the years find the treatments that had the first modest effects, and then find others, and then find combinations that proved to be highly effective, and get to the point that we're at now where there's a lot of people who are cancer survivors And so I think if we can make this effort more robust, find small things that have effects, it will lead to larger effects in the future.
Dr. Shmaskin, how do you feel about clinical trials with ALS?
I think they're important. I think that my advice for people is if you're going to try to get involved, do it very early. Most trials will exclude people who are more than 3 years past their diagnosis or first symptom. But a important part that they've reported integrating clinical care and research in this new model of care across the country. The lack of access and equity in the current system is really a major shortfall. So this new design system would integrate research and care into one system so that someone seeking care in a remote area hundreds of miles from a hospital or ALS clinic could still participate because they'd be linked to a large center that could enroll them. So I think that is an important goal from this report.
Okay. Kathy, you want to add to that?
I would like to. When Brian was first diagnosed with ALS, knowing that at that point that it was familial ALS and having gone through the experience with his mom, he specifically asked for a clinical trial. He wanted to participate. And, you know, going back to this idea where we sort of had to figure things out on our own, we would ask the neurologist as well as his PCP, are there clinical trials that Brian, you know, would be eligible for? Every medical person we asked sent us to a website for us to go and research clinical trials, for us to figure out, is there a clinical trial related to ALS? Number one, are there any? Number two, are they appropriate? Right. Does he qualify for any of those? Again, it's not a background that we have. We don't know how to do that.
Right.
So he finally stopped asking the question. We would go to the website. Occasionally, there would be a clinical trial related to ALS. We would ask about it, but he would be told he wasn't a good candidate. And then 2 years into his illness, unfortunately, at a point where he was starting to have a very significant decline, his own neurologist was starting up two specific clinical trials, and Brian was eligible for one of them. So he was able to participate, but because he was declining so quickly, he couldn't complete it. He only was able to participate for a couple of months.
Oof. Dr. Shmaskin, you want to add something?
So an important part of the new system of care can be to include research coordinators, research navigators, and care navigators.
Yeah.
So they can then bring research information directly to the patient rather than
absolutely
Kathy and I experience the same thing busily. Searching on your own and not knowing what to do.
I'm sorry. Again, I'm sorry you went through that, Kathy. Just you're on your own. Good luck. See if you can find something.
It's very defeating. I mean, when
remarkable.
You're in the face of all the extreme negativity of what you're going through, you're trying to do something to help the cause, and it's yet another hurdle.
Again, we'll post in our show notes the report, but just one more note on this part of it here. The recommendation includes that CMS and private insurers should pay for genetic testing for all people living with ALS and their families. State legislatures should examine possible measures to prohibit genetic discrimination in life insurance and long-term care. Yeah, I mean, I try not to be cynical about insurance. I know there's a lot of wonderful people working in insurance. I really try. But my concern is, number one, why are we not paying for genetic testing? And number two, can we prevent insurance companies from using that information against patients? This has been new to me, this part of the conversation. So if you're hearing about ALS, genetic components, Kathy's husband, Brian, had a familial form, which was, I think Dr. Thornton said, 5 to 10% of patients with ALS. Is that right? Okay, but real briefly, we're down to about our last minute. We had a couple questions, listeners saying, it's been in my family. Should I get tested? How do you know if you should get tested for ALS, this gene here?
Yeah, anyone who is at risk because there's a family member, particularly if it's a close family member, a sibling or a parent, I would say aunt, uncle, or grandparent would be included in that, is somebody who ought to be asking this question and who should go and see a person specifically to find out about the pros and the cons of getting a genetic test. And it's not a slam dunk. Not everyone who learns about this decides that they want to have advanced knowledge of what their risk is, but everyone should have the opportunity to make that decision.
Yes. And does it make sense to you that it should be covered by insurance to get this?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, we'll see if that recommendation goes through. Again, I want to thank our guests here. 20 seconds, Rebecca, what do you want to leave with the audience?
I think that I'd like to leave with the audience that that this was a tremendous effort on behalf of a diverse team. And I want to thank Joel, Dr. Shemaskin, for the work that he and his cohort put forth. And hopefully we'll be able to keep the momentum up and continue to advocate for some of these changes.
Rebecca Coulter with the ALS Association. Thank you for joining us this hour, Rebecca.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Charles Thornton, thank you for your expertise this hour, doctor. And I want to thank Kathy Powers, telling the story of her family and her late husband, Brian. Thank you for doing that. Thank you for advocating and for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Joel Shemaskin, best of luck to you. Thank you for sharing your story and the continued work you do on this. It is remarkable. Thank you very much, Joel.
Thanks, Evan.
And from all of us at Connections, thank you for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.